Sunday, June 9th, 2002. Happy Father's Day to everybody who happens to be a father. I'd like to dedicate this particular show to my lovely daughter who's out in Wisconsin. Her name is Talia Way. If she's listening, she should be all smiles and everything should be good for her. Today, we are going to have our second show for NYLXS. We have two guests here with us today. Our technical guru, Marco. How do you pronounce your last name?
Scoffier.
I can't pronounce that. Scoffier.
You just did it.
Yes, he's kind of scuffy.
Easier than
Gristera. No, Gristera. Right? No.
It's phonetic. I my whole life people have had trouble with his name.
Here? Okay. And we also have here Joe Gristera today, and a little bit later, hopefully, we will also see Brett Wynkoop come around. And we have a hot week this week, indeed it is, in the good old city of New York. A lot of interesting things have happened over this past week, and we hope to bring everybody up to speed as to the happenings of the local free software community. For your information, we will also be hanging out on IRC over at opensourceprojects.org or linux.org. You can just open up your xchats to irc.linux.org or irc.linux.com, and if you go into pound NYLXS, then you will find us hanging out there, and you can post questions. We promise you that at this point that we would have telephone access, and despite our best efforts this week, indeed it was not quite possible. Although Brett right now is working very hard on accomplishing that at this moment, trying to get us an illegal phone jack to hook into the phone system, believe it or not, because you can't find a legal one any longer to be able to patch into a mixing device, such as we have, something about wiretapping laws. So you're not allowed to wiretap your telephone using a phone line, but you are clearly allowed to wiretap your computer in order to prevent you from copying your DVD. In addition to that, we did make some improvements on this week system. We did get a professional mixer, and hopefully the sound that is coming out is a little bit clearer for people to hear. Let me just spread the good cheer a little bit. Okay, so we've gone through another week of much of interesting things. There's two things I promised myself after listening to last week's. First of all, we learned a couple of things after last week. First thing we learned is that we're going to laugh. We have to laugh a little quieter because at some point we blew out the
saturated
the sound waves with laughter. Unfortunately, Billy's not here tonight, so there probably won't be quite as much laughter as it is because Marco doesn't even smile and Joan. Well, he laughs sometimes, but not as much as Billy. So we probably won't have as much laughter this time around, but we'll try working on it. And, you know, laughter is good because it keeps your sense of humor up about some very serious issues. But we can all celebrate this week because thanks to the EFF and other venues, it looks like the content industry has not yet figured out a standard yet to do DMR on CDs. Basically, they're proposing that we stick things into our digital devices so that we can't copy various broadband television. And that's been stumbling along on the part of the content industry, and that was basically became a dead issue this week. And everybody who was involved in that, I would like to thank. In addition to that, we had a huge...
The open house.
Right? Open house this week, that's right. Maybe 50 people showed up, which surprised me. And I would like to give thanks to Paul Rodriguez, who runs around like a chicken every time there's an event for our organization. He brings his family members, right. When we had the demo, Paul was afraid that we wouldn't have enough people, so what Paul did was he actually walked down his block in Union City and knocked on doors and beg people to come, and then when they didn't show up, which was a big surprise to him somehow, he then went back to their houses and complained to them bitterly why they didn't show up. So, you know, what are you going to do? That's poor for you. Where do you want to start? You want to start with politics? You want to start with technical stuff?
You guys were talking politics earlier. Why don't you keep that?
Well, because this show is not.
It was a little too theoretical.
Yeah, this is not theoretical. And that was one of the reasons why I didn't want to really go over that section of politics. You know, we have been trying to debate if we should nuke Saudi Arabia or not, but Joe says no, I say yes. But we'll try to skip over that that aspect of things right now.
We might improve our listenership though. Yeah.
Well, we I don't know how many links do we have from Saudi Arabia. Okay, how many do we have from Borough Park?
Either way.
Okay. Either way. One way or the other. Let's start with technical news, I guess, or technical issues that has been happening. But let's talk a little bit about business, actually. We had an interesting week in terms of our movement on trying to get free software adopted into business. And one of the things that's happened, for example, is that we've had a lurker on the mailing list by the name of Ron Guerin. And Ron's been lurking on the mailing list for a long time. And every once in a while he shows up for an NY Fair Use meeting or for an NYLXS meeting. And Ron's sort of been watching. But this week Ron has volunteered to help lead the charge on trying to get the necessary templates that are needed for the Open Office Suite. The question would be to somebody who's not up to date on things: is why is this important? You want to go over why it's important?
Yeah, sure. I can delve into that. I'm sure you'll have something to add. But
you're the PR guy. Why is this so important?
Because this is, this is how people are doing business. I mean, a fundamental business process is, using Word templates to create various different kinds of documents or Excel spreadsheet templates to do different types of modeling and calculations. And, you know, there's a lot of accountants and lawyers' offices or doctors' offices or anybody really that's using these tools every day. And they simply couldn't work as efficiently without them. And if we intend on switching them to a free software platform, we're going to need to offer them some sort of alternative that has the same and hopefully actually increased functionality.
So what is currently on, have you downloaded OpenOffice and used it?
Yeah, I've been playing with it a little bit.
Okay. Does it come with templates already? I think the version I have only came with, seems like, two templates. One was for business cards.
Yeah, I think it came with a few. Not nearly the amount that are included in, I think, when you get Microsoft Office. And not only that, but you have a huge body of knowledge that's...
How to
make the templates, yes, already. So,
yeah. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
We need to meet that, you know. We need to address
clearly
that.
We need to meet that. This really comes down to a financial issue.
And unfortunately, too, this isn't fun work for most hackers. I mean, kids want to write Open Office. They don't want to write, you know, templates that a secretary is going to use.
Unfortunately,
so
too many kids are writing Open Office.
But
it's one of the reasons why most of the Open Office knockoffs don't look so good. Open Office is actually what's the history of Open Office? Open Office is actually started with the code base from StarOffice and was implemented as free software and has been freed. And what's nice about it, first of all, it's actually technically, as a product itself, it's technically very nice. One of the things I like about it is that unlike StarOffice, it doesn't open up into one locked down desktop. There was a problem with the original one, in my opinion, where what happened was is that when you click on it and you open it up,
It stole your desktop.
Yeah, it basically stole your desktop, exactly. It took over your entire desktop and everything was in the desktop.
It's very disorientating.
It was just annoying. It ran in Java, too, which was slow as a horse.
Yeah.
It took a lot of CPU power to run. And
they did change that in StarOffice 6, I think, though. they...
Right. That was actually part of the open office work,
yeah.
And that was ported over to Star Office 6, and it's less dependent, if I'm not mistaken, on Java than it was before.
It seems so, certainly.
However, the ability to create plug-in applications for Word is something that a lot of businesses leverage internally, and it does become quite a problem, actually, with... It becomes quite a problem with trying to get people to move onto a different system. Is that not only are they saying that they need to have their application, but they more importantly, what they need is their damn program that runs in Word. And a lot of people actually have Word documents or templates. We're talking about to Moshe Levy, right? That's what he posted on the mailing list. Is that he was trying to move people open office, but they have certain files that they can accelerate their work through when it comes to interfacing with the government because the templates are already constructed for them in Word, and then all they have to do is use macros enter data and to redo it. So this is a pretty big thing. From a lawyer's perspective, law firms almost completely a function off of dynamic documents that are in not in Word, but actually in WordPerfect.
Well, sure, yeah. They were there.
Real estate offices have this problem. Their stuff also is locked into the.
I'm not sure I know a business that doesn't use these templates, frankly.
Right. So
I mean, they're extremely prolific. Yeah.
Right. So there's basically two issues. The first issue is I'm looking for the card for the guy who runs actually.
We're gonna do a personal call out to.
Yes, call him personally. His name is I do have his business card here somewhere. His name is the guy who's opening, who's running the Open Office symposium for Sun. His name is Sam Heisel. If I'm not making a mistake, but I could be making a mistake. And of course, we're broadcasting it all over the United States right now. We have hundreds of people hooked up to us, by the way. How many? Couple hundred. We lost track.
That's right. So hop on the bandwagon. And
yes. I think his name is Larry Heisel, though. But if you want to know more about getting involved in the Open Office project in the general sense, you can go to
www.openoffice.org.
And, of course, the only business card I have left from the Business Expo has nothing. The business card has no telephone number. It just says openoffice.org, and then it says, join the community and hack the code. Ha ha ha, like that's a lot of fun. Okay, announce-subscribe@openoffice.org. That's the email address they give you for contact information. That's brilliant. Do you need this anymore? Okay. So, that's not too useful. But, if you go to their website, you will find their number of mailing lists to be on. I think actually the most interesting one from my perspective is the marketing one, because this is where they're actually trying to market the thing into business. that being said, basically we have two needs that hopefully Ron's going to help us with. The first need is...
We got the templates, and then...
Well, the first need is actually templates. We need templates, right?
That's right.
The other thing we need is actually...
Training?
Training, yes. Yeah. Well, actually three things, including training. But when there's two different trainings in. The first thing that we need is templates themselves, but we also need to get a number of people who are capable of creating templates with OpenOffice. In other words, to learn actually the coding language that's involved with that.
So we can guarantee some support for these businesses that adopt that platform.
Not only that, but we can get them work. When it's good if Marco, who is a big-time Linux consultant right now, goes to... I don't know. What's the Helmsley Spear, right? And he wants to convert their office. That he says that to them that we can generate, and I can get we can generate so many.
Tell me next time you're gonna cough. Okay. I'll drop the million.
Okay.
Yeah, no more so coughing, Ruben.
You get so many templates that you need. You spec out the templates, and we can get the functionality out of the office suite, and that he can then outsource that that work to people that we have that are known to have the ability. How do we know it? Because they've been building templates and they've basically been GPLing them. The other issue so people that are involved in this, if you want to be involved in this because you're looking for something that can be potentially lucrative, this is potentially something that's very lucrative. If you're twiddling around with your free software and you're trying to figure out, how do I make money off of this? Well, you know what? This is it. This is one of the major ways that you can potentially make money. Is it going to happen in a month? Maybe not. Will it happen maybe in 2 months? Maybe not. But clearly, I think that in the next quarter, we're going to be generating sales for Office products, and we're going and we're going to have to know people who. Never mind. We're gonna have to know people who are capable of handling this and work with those people, and we are obviously trying to develop the skill sets among people who are members of NYLFSS in order to do that, as well as in the larger community. That's number one. The other thing that is important is training, and I did speak to my friend who is a professional trainer. For Office right now, Microsoft Office, and she's very excited about doing training with OpenOffice in general. And I'm very excited about it also, because I'm very excited about her, and I'm also very excited about the fact that she can do the training. I happen to know that she's really excellent at this and very meticulous at doing these things, and she's already working on hopefully doing getting actual books and online.
Well, yeah, I think that's the other thing that's important too, is getting Sam's Learn This in 21 Days tutorials published. And
Sam says you can learn C programming in 24 hours. I give OpenOffice 20 minutes, at least. Right.
Well, in any event, but yeah, having literature out there available to the people is, right next to the Learn VBA. You know, we need. To have
well, that would be kind of interesting for Diane to publish her own book. That would be interesting, but just in terms of actually training itself, when you do the training, I do the training when I teach the Pearl Class, for example. I teach it off the website.
Right.
She wants to actually is actually going to create, I think, a booklet that she's going to hand out.
That's good.
So that's good.
Yeah, that's great.
No, it's good. It's really wonderful. I'm really looking forward to it. And hopefully that by the end of the month, Diane will be hopefully mostly done with this aspect of things. So that's one thing that's happening that's pretty exciting right now on the business end. One of the interesting things that we've been debating, though, and it came up in last week's open session, was if the adaptation rate right now of free software and businesses escalating or decreasing. And it really seems that some people think that it's increasing. I would beg to differ from my experience. What do you think?
I would have to say from mine that it's if it's not decreasing, then it's definitely plateaued. I think it has found a place in certain areas. You know, for example, right, the Apache web server is clearly probably one of the most successful free software projects around, or SendMail maybe. Plenty of people using SendMail, but at a certain domains, certainly it's not being adopted at all and never was, particularly on the desktop. I don't know of too many people using it on the desktop in a business environment. It really seems to be something relegated to computer science departments certain web
Well, I think that even more than that is what's happened is that even from the server market, I think that there's beginning to see a decline in the use of it from even the server market. And that is particularly disheartening, in my opinion.
Well, especially, yeah, I mean, that being touted as its biggest strength, and now if we're losing footing in that market, it is discouraging.
Well, although IBM says that they're making progress in that field, but I think that's questionable. They might be making progress in that field, but I have a feeling, though, that a lot of IBM's replacements is one to Linux servers or GNU Linux servers for another GNU Linux server platform.
Well, they're pushing it on the mainframe heavily.
Right.
And
Right.
Which is nice, but, that's certainly not a mainstream market to buy big iron like that. I mean, there's...
They're trying to actually push it, as it, but... Um, How much competition is there about the desktop? I mean, the desktop, with that desktop implementation, I don't see how any server market is secure. The reason why...
Well, that's right. If the server can't talk to the desktop is essentially... Well, the server then is essentially useless. Or they both are, however
right.
you want to look at it. But
you want to extrapolate on that?
Extrapolate?
Mm-hmm.
Sure. I guess to use your example of Samba, right? If Microsoft decided tomorrow to change... the way that the Samba protocols that would make Linux useless as a file server to Windows desktops, and so essentially the person who controls the desktop can control the protocols that desktop understands, and if the server machines can't keep up, then they will simply not function. You know, I guess that's even something to point out too, that if we allow Microsoft to keep its footing on the desktop, we're always going to be playing this cat and mouse game where we're chasing their protocol changes, and that frankly is a loser's game in my opinion. You know, we simply it's a complete waste of resources. You're never innovating. You're only trying to replicate somebody else's efforts. Instead, we won't be producing the sort of cutting edge and innovative and really amazing things that free software has the potential to do. And that will certainly that will be a shame.
So how do you feel then about the current hubbubble that you hear about evolution?
You want to clarify on hubbubble?
A lot of people saying evolution is going to save free software on the desktop. And,
with what, connector? I mean, that's, that's just what we were talking about. There's another thing. And even if Zimian has sort of Microsoft's secret blessing, oh, no, we won't change it, maybe they mean they won't change it next month, but who's to say they're not going to change it at some point down in the future? And I don't know why we would ever trust them to not change it. Evolution is certainly, I think, a useful piece of software, and it certainly helps somebody who's moving from Outlook to feel comfortable. But we really need to, again, be focusing on making not free software the same as what they've got right now, but something better, something innovative. Give them really a reason to change, other than the freedoms. So if we're ever really going to make any headway, we've got to gain ground in the market where end users are actually using their computers, hence the desktop.
Really, in my opinion, the desktop is actually innovative in its own right, and I think the sale has been not right about that, because there are several desktops, I think, that are have been ready for business, I think, for many years, that they are networkable, and they are lightweight, and flexible, and from an IT... positions point of view, they're more controllable remotely to make sure that your users don't mess up the desktop and can drive down IT costs, which is a huge thing.
That's right. I mean, X is built right off the bat to do sort of thin client technologies, and you can begin to truly standardize, and you'd have much less of the problem of people downloading software that they shouldn't be downloading, and I think it's easier to address those issues.
In addition to that, they're also more usable in many respects. A prime example for that is like WinMaker, right? WinMaker was built off of built and played off of NextStep,
mm-hmm.
and AfterStep, and it has its own widget set, which is really an AfterStep widget set, which a few years ago was pretty hot. GTK, or not like GTK, but was a hot widget set to utilize, and in some ways, I think it's actually easier to implement. And yet, there's been resistance about WinMaker, which is, it's not really resistance about WinMaker, but...
Well, it's certainly probably got a smaller market than Genome or KDE. It's maybe
it's
not
simpler
as...
simpler than the Mac interface, though, really.
Well, yeah, WinMaker is probably the most straightforward interface you can get. Or that I've ever seen on any desktop, frankly.
Yeah, it's effective. It gives you multiple desktops. You can drive things along. It's easy to dock things. Right?
That's the biggest thing.
Easy
I can't
to lock down. It's got no CPU usage. There's nothing I hate more than a desktop that uses more CPU usage than the application.
That's right. I can't even understand though how people work without multiple desktops. By the way, I can't believe that functionality was never stolen or copied by proprietary systems. But
well, that's a matter of control. They want to have control of the system. And if they're going to have control of the system, then they need to do that.
I mean, I feel like people have no idea what they're missing until they work in that kind of environment.
Oh, yeah. This is one of the things. And, you know, that's the great thing about free software, of anything. The best thing about it is that they say the GPL is viral. That's completely not true. The GPL is not viral, but free software is. Once you get used to using a desktop like WinMaker,
but you know,
you
but
never
the, you know, that's
back.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean,
you can't go back because you feel like an idiot going back. Like suddenly you're constrained in this playpen.
That's right. Yeah.
Which is the best way of putting it? What is Microsoft software like? And it's not just Microsoft. What's Mac software like? It's like being locked into a playpen, and you can only play so much with your playpen, and that's it. And then you're constrained by the bars. In the case of WinMaker, you have really a lightweight but yet very powerful desktop that is highly usable, and it is clearly. I mean, if I was going to go over and create a system that included, I had to start from scratch to create an IT department for a pool of secretaries and lawyers, and I needed to implement the desktop. Clearly, I would be implementing not only free software on the desktop, but I would probably be using WinMaker. And the reason is, I can lock it down so that certain widgets always show, and then I could also, so no matter what happens, there's always those widgets. I can run the programs off of powerful servers and have them display only on the server. I have complete interoperability with networking. I have, no drag to escalate the desktop further up in order just to work because the desktop is locked in. And I have a much more comfortable environment for my people to work in. And, of course, the desktops themselves, servers, workstations, PCs, they're all the same thing. The computers themselves don't have to be turned off, which itself makes work easier. Because when you leave at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, you just leave your desktop and you lock it.
That's right.
And
yeah.
Come back, and it's exactly like it was the next morning. And that's another huge advantage. And it's not big on the CPU, so there's no reason to drag your computers out of out of production simply because the operating system.
That's right. I mean, you could still easily have people running a 46 machine and extremely powerful applications. And
well, actually, that was the reason why I originally used WinMaker, because I needed something to run on a 486.
Yeah. And then, you don't notice any sort of decline in performance. I mean, you can't see the windows redrawing themselves and things like that. I mean, it's snappy and it works really well.
So why is the failure in adoption?
Well, that's a people aren't evangelizing this enough. I mean,
so you're saying we don't have enough professional salespeople?
I think there's a big void there. I think it's pretty tough to compete with. I mean, these companies hire professional people that sell for a living. You know, they know how to do it really well, and they're really effective. And they go in there with their big glossy photos and PowerPoint presentations and not only the excellent salesmen, but they're selling support contracts
need it very badly.
What was that?
Which they'll need very badly.
Oh yes, which they do need absolutely, and that may be frankly there needs to be a bit of a professionalization, I think, in the free software community. Where, it's not going to be good enough for a business to, do a Google search on old Usenet postings. I mean, they're going to need somebody to call when things break and say, come in and fix this now.
So they can do a search on Google, right?
That's right, yeah. Essentially, but, I mean, I think that this always comes down to a bit of an accountability issue. I mean, these companies want to be able to pass the buck when things fail and be able to sort of make somebody else share their problem with them. And there's a certain, I think there's just a comfort that comes with a support contract. And, you know, until we can provide that.
There's no there's no warranties when you get the support contract. There's just hope that something will.
Well, that's right, but that, you know, that hope apparently, you know, I think it works. I mean, you know, clearly, right? I mean, there's plenty. You know, what major business doesn't have support contracts on their mission critical systems? I don't think I know of any.
How many of them are effective? Experience.
I would say that I think it varies, but I certainly wouldn't say that they're 100% effective, or they're certainly not 100% effective the first time they come out. I mean, you know, I've had plenty of experiences where support guys come out and they got to either, you know, they got to come back because they got to order a part or what, you know, I mean, or they just don't know or whatever it is. So, I mean, you know.
Because from my experience, even with support contracts, that the they're a failure. I mean, the guys come out, they tinker around with things, they kick things around, and it is really a problem of any serious magnitude. They wind up needing to then go to up a level, to say the least. And even that doesn't help. Even when they go up a level,
right.
Sometimes, you know, that doesn't help. I mean, we just had the same problem with Canon, right? Canon, and here's a very interesting situation. Canon printers, right? They had this copy printer called the Image Runner 5000, or Image Runner 6000, which is a copy machine slash printer that you may or may not be familiar with. Now, here's the interesting thing about this Canon printer. The Canon printer itself is network-ready because embedded into the system is, ta-da, Linux. All right?
Surprise, surprise.
Surprise, surprise. According to this, okay. Now, the problem is that if you try to run through Samba, an SMB, an LP port, right, through Samba, through regular print LP services, to try to control the printer, which is a normal thing that you would do with printers, so you have a centralized place for location and control, then what would happen is that... It would stop working. You can get regular PostScript printing out of it because it's a PostScript printer, but the advanced features to the software, that you would not be able to get working. And, of course, you know, when you spend $10,000 for a printer, the ability to do...
You want everything to work.
Right,
I mean.
Right. You certainly want...
You don't want to pay $10,000 for a quarter of the functionality or...
Yeah, just to create basically an HP laser jet.
That's right, yeah. A fast laser jet.
Not even that fast, as a matter of fact. And as a result is that trying to run it through the regular file server through Linux, it doesn't work. All right. Now here they are actually familiar with the operating system. They're even running Samba on the client itself. Right. The problem really has to be, first understand how printers work. Right. Printers, they send out a spool of information. Right. In some type of, you know, hex code or text code.
Yeah.
The printer gets that information, and then it digests that, and then retranslates it into the necessary physical actions that are necessary for the page to print. Now, the problem with the copy machine is that it's got to send information back to the server or to the machine that's sending the information. Now, what that means is, now printing is usually a unidirectional process. The information comes from a client, gets sent to the print server.
Which
the print server spools the information, then sends it out as a stream to the, either by filtering it or not filtering it, to the printer in a language that the printer understands. That's what it does. There is no two-way communication process generally here. So in order to implement a two-way communication process, they built some customized stuff into the printer on the Canon side, and but yet they would not even disclose or discuss in any way, shape, or form any way of how to reproduce that information or on the print server. So what does that mean? So that means that if we have two offices, one in California and one in New York, and we have this printer and we have a VPN network in between them, right? Mm-hmm. We would like to be able to print without using the fax machine information directly through the network through the VPN from California to print out onto the New York City copy machine, right? And that would be terrific. The problem that we have is it doesn't work. Why? Because Canon refuses to disclose the information that's necessary, better yet, just to give us the source code that's necessary to compile an appropriate driver for the server on the LPD principle. Now, this type of level of support is provided for NT, and this type of level of support is provided for other closed source operating systems, but they absolutely refuse to handle this problem in terms of free software. They refuse to give the sourceware code away. And the guy that was the engineer that came over and spoke to me says, "Well, I think it's running Linux on the inside of there." And I said, "Really?" He says, "Oh, yeah." I said, "So let him just give me the same code that he's using there, and I can use it on my principal." And he said, "No, they won't do that. He'll never give away that information."
That's kind of, you know, it's funny in a really sick way, right? I mean, you know, you're buying a printer from somebody. I mean, why?
Yeah, cheap one, $10,000.
That's right. But I guess the point is,
the source code worth. The source code's worth nothing to anybody except to somebody who owns the printer.
That's right. I mean, you know, you're buying a piece of hardware. I mean, why should you be constrained to a single platform that you can use that piece of hardware with? You know, that's like, I don't know, if you bought a Honda, you had to use Exxon gasoline, or even worse than that. I mean, they're telling you how you know. Something that should be completely independent of the printer, you know, but is now.
Much worse than that, because they're basically running the same type of operating system within the either BSD or might be Linux. You may be wrong, it may be BSD on the inside, but whatever it is, there he's basically running. I think it is GNU Linux, and that's one of the things that's irritating me the most about this whole thing. Is I got a feeling that it is Linux, and so if it is Linux, then basically Canon is in violation of the GPL.
That's right. I mean, they're taking from the pool and not giving back.
Well,
I mean,
they're distributing the source. Yeah. They're distributing the software without giving the source code.
That's right. Yeah, but I mean, essentially, they're trying to subvert they're subverting the GPL.
You have
a kind of tragedy of the commons situation. You know,
that's right.
I mean, it's outright theft from the public, and it's
a direct violation.
These are the kinds of things too that.
This is actually one of the reasons why it is in the first place that there is a GPL. And when people talk about how do you get more freedom, you know, there's this one idiot that runs around, BSD guy. Not that all BSD guys are idiots, because they clearly are not all idiots, nor are they all stupid or wrong. But there just happens to be this one individual that always runs around, and the first thing he gets up there for any free software event that involves the FSF, and he goes, that GPL, it's stealing food from the mouths of children because of its viral properties. He says, it's not free. Free is like a BSD license because you're free to do whatever you want with it. Well, there's a number of issues with that. The first one is that the guy needs more Thorazine.
Well, you know, I think people aren't grasping why that difference between a BSD-style license and the GPL, you know, the difference of...
The BSD license, they make it sound like the BSD license is something that somebody thought out. It was an accident. It's a historical accident. I'm sure that people who wrote the BSD license gave it about 25 minutes worth of their time.
I mean, it basically just says you can do absolutely whatever you want with it.
And that's actually the problem. The problem is what is freedom. Freedom is the freedom to be... freedom is the freedom to be responsible for your own destiny and your own life. It's not necessarily always where you have the most amount of choices. So clearly, there is an aspect of choice and freedom. But clearly, every choice that every individual makes impedes in some way on freedom of other people.
Well, this is a freedom to not be stolen from, essentially.
I want all
those
people out there listening to stop breathing, because she's stealing my ear.
But, you know, it's a... you know, I think it's just the freedom to not be stolen from that the GPL guarantees. I mean, basically, you know, the GPL forces or tries to address the free rider problem in some way. And in that, you know, if you're going to...
That's not really what it's trying to address, and the free rider, that's not what the concern is.
Well, I think...
The concern is exactly what this thing like Canon did. By Canon's use of the copy of their software in order to implement a proprietary interface, even if it's on a free software platform like a BSD platform, let's say that's not GPL, then it's really, they're really running it on BSD. Well, in that case, which I doubt, by the way, but let's say that is the case, right, and they're on a BSD platform, and then what they're doing is that they're exercising their freedom to basically step on my toes so my network can't work. And that is That is exactly what we're talking about. Freedom is something that's imbalanced where people have to make choices as individuals, and it's never absolute, and there's always boundaries to it. The thing of a good system that really provides freedom is a system that provides freedom where it guarantees that the pursuit of happiness of the individuals that are involved in that social system have a fairly decent equal opportunity at providing themselves empowerment through whatever social mechanism that we're talking about.
Yeah.
In this case, the social mechanism is code production and using the computer software and hardware for the business's capability. And in this case, it's being obstructed by the quote-unquote use of freedom to hide that code base from the people who actually buy the system. That's unacceptable. And particularly in this case, it's unacceptable. And that's what the problem is. So they're all willing to yak around about freedom. The question is, what is freedom exactly, and how do you provide that for individuals? And the GPL is designed to take into account the variety of needs of individuals to have freedom in the relationship to the software and to guarantee it for them and for future generations. Whereas the BSD license doesn't do any such thing.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think even as much as it's a freedom issue, it's a security issue, too. I mean, that's...
that's another problem.
Right.
That was...
Well, I guess I mean secure in that, you know, you don't have to worry about the sort of the code being reappropriated or taken out of the public domain or limited in some way. Or not that it's in the public domain, I shouldn't say that, but, you know, I mean, essentially they're closing up that source. And the GPL, at least as it's written, is meant to prevent any of that software from being closed off.
Right.
To its users, you know, which the BSD license does not prevent. So, you know, that the BSD is sort of, it's really kind of like anarchy in a way, you know, because it's just essentially anyone can do whatever they want with that code, you know, but that's...
which is exactly what Mac OS did. In fact, you know, the Darwin OS that is the BSD OS that's running underneath the Macintoshes right now is clearly not a fully functional system.
Right, well, yeah, there's no desktop, it's just...
It's not only no desktop, the system itself doesn't even work correctly, unless you put the Macintosh plugs in there, or you build your own plugs for it.
Well, you can get it down to a prompt.
Well, that's
for all you...
I can do that with a...
I mean, you can bypass the graphical part of that. I mean, you don't have to boot up into...
Right, but even built into the non-graphical user interface system, there are parts that are proprietary on the Mac. When you're running FreeBSD on the Mac, you're running, not FreeBSD, you're really running Darwin. It's not really FreeBSD. And in addition to that, the truth of the matter is it's not a free OS, no matter how you slice it, because Darwin itself is not functional. Darwin itself is not functional. And this is a big issue. But here's exactly the problem, right? Here we have, Apple basically running their proprietary stuff, and there's no... if you run X in those systems, it runs twice as slow as it would normally on a regular free BSD system, for example, because they kludged it. But they're not freeing up their own operating system parts, which would allow people actually to use it. So I don't know why anybody runs OS X, frankly. I just don't understand the point. Why run OS X, which is a locked-down system where you have to buy everything piecemeal? It doesn't even have the application support that Linux has, let alone what Windows has. And yet And yet, people who use it, it's mind-boggling. Why buy an imitation when you can get the real thing? I mean, if you really want to do it, then just get FreeBSD and learn.
I mean, I mean, there are things about it that that are nice to use, but, you know, but those are feature things, you know, and I guess the overall freedom certainly isn't there. And certainly application support isn't there.
No, clearly the application support's not there. And Adobe doesn't want to put application support for the Mac OS X on their thing because they're afraid that somebody's going to hack it.
Well, they have done it, actually. Photoshop 7 is OS X native.
Did they?
Yeah. And the next line of Macromedia stuff, Macromedia MX products, which just came out, actually.
Well, that's probably the best reason that I can think of for not using OS X then. Macromedia runs on, stay away from it. But, I really do need those Flash pages.
I maintain that Flash is kind of cool.
No, it's not, but that's all right.
But, I mean, we should have something like it, or we should have a compliment.
No, we do have something like it. It's called X.
Not exactly, but...
Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't work in a web browser. But that's it. I mean, you want video games? Run video games.
Right. Well, to a certain degree, what you know, you can look at Flash as sort of a lightweight.
It's a vector graphics drawing implementation.
Yeah.
There's a half dozen, really, on a desktop.
On a desktop,
already.
Right? Yeah.
Already.
But
yeah. So if you want to run them remotely, you just build something like XMS and just run it remotely. It's just a freaking drawing program. I mean, it's a big deal of a graphics animation program, which is completely junk. There's nothing to it.
Right, but it's there, and it's, you know...
It's embedded in the browser.
Yeah. They have the browser plugins, and, well, they have a standalone player, too, which is actually...
Well, of course they have a standalone browser or a player. How do you think it gets into the,
yeah.
gets into the browser?
Well, I mean, it's slightly different. I mean, you know, they essentially just take the engine that runs the files and then just, you know, make it so you can open it up without the browser, but... I mean, that's, you know, not saying that that's a big technical leap, but... I mean, you know, you can do kind of, it allows people to do cool things. I mean, it's, you know, I would say before Flash, to get that kind of animation through was just really not possible, at least, you know, outside the free software world. I mean, of course, we could have done this with X and you know, graphics programs running remotely from X, but that, you know... As we all know, that was not the dominant platform, and you know, Flash addressed that need in that market.
So Sony writes to us that there is something like Flash called SVG.
Oh, scalable vector graphics.
Well, yeah,
yeah.
Actually, that's just what I was saying. And you're saying you can't hear Ruben?
That's hard to believe. but frankly, you know, I would. While SVG is certainly promising,
how about now?
The maturity of the. I think the maturity of those applications is not really where the Flash application is at. So I guess, you know, until those applications mature, you simply just can't expect people to switch.
Okay. So I have a different question now. Related to things. It was just recently was the case where our sister organization, very good organization, by the way, by the name of Deluge, right?
Sure, yeah.
Deluge is run by Mark Aguera, who lives in Queens. He's a fine individual, one of the nicest guys I've ever met, an old OS2 guy. And what he did is, he's running a series of programs right now for his organization by commercial vendors that have non-free products on free software. And they were very excited about this, and they recently had, for example, Apigen... They had Apigen give their presentation for their products. And Marco, did you go to the Apigen speech? Okay. Did you go?
No, I didn't see that either.
Okay.
But we heard, I guess we got some secondhand reports.
Yeah, we got
reports.
A lot of excited secondhand feedback. Now, I'll tell you my experience with Apigen.
They really must have dazzled those guys because everyone that we talked to, I think, there was a few people at the open.
Well,
yeah,
they
gave away
swag, which is a big winner.
That's right.
Here's this.
Yeah, we need more swag. We got to,
yeah,
you know.
We need more swag. Clearly, we need more swag for our meetings.
You know, maybe a deck of cards with naked girls on the back or something. Or,
which naked girls? Anyway. Yeah, it depends clearly on which one.
Well, of course. It's, you know.
Here's the, when I tried to load Apigen on a SUSE for a customer or a client, right? I loaded it up, and it wouldn't install. This was on SUSE. It wouldn't work. Period. It wouldn't work. Just wouldn't work. Flat out, wouldn't work on SUSE.
Yeah.
All right. It runs on Java. It's closed source. I spent a lot of time talking to the guys, from the tech support guys, trying to get it to work. It still couldn't get it to work. I finally tried to start fixing their shell script that was trying to get things started. And it seems like even the Java runtime environment itself seemed to fail on that platform. But the problem was the source code wasn't there.
Well, that's right. I mean, it would have been not saying that it would have been trivial to fix if you had the source code, but it would have been certainly a problem you could have addressed had it been sort of an open box that you could have looked into.
Well, this goes beyond that. If they would have given me a tarball, I could have done /configure make install.
Well, yeah.
And it would have configured itself for the system as it sorted and viewed the system, and it would have worked.
And you can always point it to libraries too, even with configure. Yeah.
If you need to. But usually that configure will work on almost any GNU Linux platform.
Yeah, I would say 98% of the time.
Right. In fact, I have never remembered a tarball not working that ran through config. Although I did have problems working with Elm this week, that's because I didn't read the directions. Now the thing is, that opportunity is not there. It's the same problem I had when I tried to install Oracle and Red Hat originally.
That's a fucking nightmare for anyone who's ever tried it. I mean, it's like, I spent days trying to get Oracle to run on Red Hat. You know, it's really not easy.
Well, this was my experience with it. It was very interesting. What I had to do was first of all, when I ran the installation disk directly out of the box, what happened is, of course, it completely died somewhere in the middle of the installation. It had this big Java thing.
Saying
that you couldn't do these things in Flash, but there they were in Java. They were sliding the images up and down and running
the
background.
Not to mention that it doesn't use a mainstream version of the Java runtime. You got to go and download some, ancient IBM.
You had to actually get it from at that time from Black. All right. So after it died, now it left because it died with about 900 incomplete and broken little configuration files all over the damn hard drive, right? Which completely sucked.
It's messy,
right?
And what really pissed me off about the whole thing is the only reason that I even wanted to install Oracle on the machine was so that I could get the damn DBD Oracle driver to compile.
You can't compile DBD with Oracle for Perl without the...
Oracle's got to be the most...
They couldn't give you just the damn client.
Yeah, that's right.
They
had
to give you the whole freaking thing.
I mean, you pay enough for Oracle, and they can't even just hand you the Perl driver for it. I mean, it's...
Yeah, it's pretty heartbreaking as far as that's concerned.
I mean, I guess that product certainly has its strong points, but, it's definitely, it's either their way or the sort of highway.
Well, it definitely guarantees job security.
Yeah, well, that's true. I don't know any Oracle people out of work, but if you know how to tame that beast, then they'll never let you go.
Well, yeah, really, that's true. they'll almost triple your salary to keep you on, even in a recession. Now, the thing is this. What happens is... Okay, so now I'm stuck, right? The thing breaks down in the middle of installation, and I had these 900. So I sit there, I call up the tech support guys, right? Which are right away they tell me they don't have tech support, that we have to spend another $125,000 for this. But he says, since you're involved with the free software in New York City, and NYU really has a site license, we will entertain you, and we'll walk through it. And the guy just wanted to do it anyway, because frankly he was using me as a guinea pig for their installation process. He walked me, I have to hand it to him, he walked through every one of the, he walked right through every one of the files, and he knew the system like the back of his hand. I was like blown away. I mean, this is unbelievable. This guy's like a PhD in hacking Oracle.
Which is, certainly his knowledge is impressive, but you have to feel sorry for this guy who's clearly devoted a lot of time to learning the system that is essentially, as soon as Oracle's like, we don't want to do it that way. How does he transfer that knowledge then?
Oracle's so large that they never transfer that much. One of the things, the good thing about Oracle is that if you do know Oracle, unlike almost any other commercial product, it's going to be here today, it's going to be here tomorrow, and it's definitely not going anywhere. We do hope that we have open source at some time, but that's another track of the conversation. But we walked right through it. We literally had to hack the whole thing by hand. And then I had to download a patch. All
right. You have to patch your kernel.
Right, I had to patch my kernel, but then I had to download a patch to the Oracle installation itself,
which
gave me a private FTP server to, right? So I did that, and then we finally got it up and running. It took 3 days.
Yeah.
And all through this time, I kept saying to him, why don't you just give me the source code? I'll compile it. Come on, give me the source code. I'll compile it. Really, I'll compile it. It'll work. You'll see. I'll compile it. Let me just compile it. Because they had been denying that they had been running Oracle on GNU Linux for years, even though they had been running it in-house, and they had other locations. Yeah. For years, and they just refused to admit that they were actually running the software.
Well, I find it hard to believe that there's any development shop that doesn't have at least one Linux box in it. I mean, you're talking about guys who program all day. They're just even for fun, how can they not have a box laying around that they do work on? I mean,
well, I'd probably agree with you, but this underlines the problem though with commercial processes. On free software, it's not that really that I'm trying to discourage any commercial vendor from putting their stuff on the platform. I clearly would rather them port their stuff to the platform than not port the stuff to the platform. Although Rich Stallman would probably disagree with that, or he may not, or he may say it's no difference, but I think it's difference. But there are very clear issues and problems, even with commercial products that are on free software. And any company that really wants to court the free software business really should be approached about actually, opening up the source code, and not just opening up the source code because in itself that's worthless, but also putting it under an open source license, but a free software license, so that the source code can actually be used on and on and on for whatever time there is. And that's never going to happen with Oracle.
They
charge $100,000 just to give you real encryption.
Just to play devil's advocate a little here, though, there was people who would say that this is not as much a problem with the commercial side of things, but with the fragmentation of Linux distributions and every distribution wanting to sort of rework where libraries sit and...
Right, that's not a problem, right? Because of autoconf. And that's why...
Well, in theory, right.
It's not in theory, it's a fact. In fact, that's why I had done the in-service, why I felt it was very important to do the in-service on autoconf, because if you remember me having that conversation...
I guess that's the thing. If you use autoconf correctly, then it doesn't matter where you put your libraries.
Yeah, it should find them. I mean, reasonably, if you put them anywhere reasonably, you should be able to find them. And autoconf is designed to take care of that problem, and David Sugar gave a beautiful spiel on that. I'm still waiting for his paperwork. Hopefully we'll have it by the time of the...
Do we have it for download yet?
Not yet. Mm-hmm. David promised it. David generally delivers what he promises, so we're hoping.
But he's a busy guy, so we cut him some slack, right?
Oh, he's busy. He's got a wife and kids. His wife is Louise. She's a lovely lady. And we'll hope that he'll get that to us soon, but... This is not just a problem at this point, even with the commercial software, but even with the free software products, right, the same problem. We're looking at the situation where they just do not have, they're so RPM-based now, and so that the development libraries that exist underneath these things are in chaos. It's almost impossible at this point to compile Gnome, and that's a free software project.
That's right, yeah. Which, I mean, if you can't compile it and you can only... download the binaries, then you almost essentially take the legs out from under it. I mean, or you take all the benefits of it being free software away.
Right. Other than that, they always blame it on the user's fault that you can't compile it. They say that you shouldn't be compiling it if you don't know how. Give me some slack. Apache never had a problem with it. It just always compiles. Why should Gnome be any harder?
That's right. We did that last week, right? From Mod Perl, no less. Compiled Mod Perl and Apache at the same time. And
while we're doing the show?
Last week.
Probably. Yeah. I do it all the time.
Yeah,
but,
but that, a 2-year-old could compile Apache and get it running.
Okay. In any event, in addition to the issues with autoconf and source card availability, there is always the possibility that if you become dependent on a commercial product, that basically they circumvent the freedom that you have with the operating system in the first place, and all the problems that exist can basically come into place. There have actually been business plans designed to actually do just that by creating some type of commercial implementation for a X-Windows set that they hope that you can't run without their set on those applications, and they become important enough to the X desktop, then you become completely reliant on them, and basically they've done an end run around the GPL and the Linux kernel freedoms. And the prime example of that was that terrible desktop, I just can't stand it, makes my skin crawl, called KDE, which can't even figure out which autoconf it wants to use when you try to compile it.
Thanks to Sonny for pointing that out.
So, actually, I'm not sure what the status is of the Qt library set right now.
I think they were finally GPL'd, if I'm not mistaken, but there was a long time there that they weren't GPL, and you had this whole system built around these proprietary libraries that, you know, which is kind of, it always really shocked me. I couldn't believe that people would donate so much of their effort and time and, you know.
Because they don't get it. They don't understand the fundamental problems or principles that are involved. And that's that. Nevertheless,
Sonny would like to blame the GNU people for breaking AT. Is that? Or AutoConf?
Yes. In any event. That's why they're not letting Sonny out of high school yet. We're working on him. We'll straighten him out. Sonny at one time told me that he would never put X on a server because it would destroy the server. So you have to put everything in perspective. You know, when we met Sonny, when at the second NYLXS meeting, it was a very interesting meeting. It consisted of me, Liz, and Sonny. And then I think later on, Sonny left and Billy Donahue showed up. And me and Liz and Billy had dinner. That was our second show.
Ruben, we're being accused of censorship.
There you go.
What is it, Sonny, that you want us to point out? What did we leave out there? We got to give him 7 seconds, right?
Okay.
Well, we certainly don't want to be accused of censorship. So
no. We won't have censorship. Although I've been accused of being a censor.
Sonny seems to feel that KDE is the last major desktop we have to get people to use Linux. And I would say that Sonny is completely mistaken, because every person that I've ever shown GNOME to is just blown away. I mean, you know.
GNOME looks good, but it's got all the problems that we were talking about. And of course, I think that the whole thing is kind of like following. I use GNOME, but I use it in a way that's very unlike the way GNOME was intended on being used in any event.
Well, you hack it to have WinMaker as your window manager, right?
Well, yeah, the two don't even work well together. So that's that doesn't take a hack. It's actually a built-in functionality, but the two don't work well together. But the main thing that I want GNOME for is to have, you know, the panel, obviously, which is nice. But until Nautilus came out, there wasn't even a decent file manager for it. Nautilus is pretty decent.
Nautilus is, I would say, very decent. I mean, you get a lot of. I mean, it could be a little
just like
faster,
the Windows,
but
it's just like the Windows thing.
I would say it's better, though. I mean, you can do things. You can mark the little files and stuff like that. And
is it better?
I think
there were
a
number of problems.
And also, you know what it does? You get a little preview of the text in your text files, which is very cool.
I don't know if the Windows platform does that or not.
I don't think it does.
I don't think it really matters to me anyway. I'll tell you what the problem that I have with it is. This is that. The first problem is that the concept of drag and drop doesn't translate directly well in Unix as it does in Windows or Macs. Because when you drag and drop something in Mac, it creates this invisible link, or it actually moves the application, and it has those two choices. But in Unix, you have more than those choices in terms of dealing with files. So let's say I want to take file A, which is something under user local games, right?
Right.
It's some game that I like, Crossfire or F-Risk, right? And I want to put it onto my desktop. The problem that I have is that when I drag it, it actually tries to copy the file from one location to the other location. That doesn't work. The what you want it to do, if you're going to drag it onto your desktop, and on top of that, it doesn't even go into a place that's in your path. It goes into something called .genome.desktop.
Oh, yeah,
like
yeah,
that.
That's right. Yeah,
yeah, so you can't even run it from the command line. It's completely no good. What you want it to do is create a link.
That's right. We have symbolic links. So
right, so I right-clicked on it. I right-clicked on it to try to get it to do that, and of course we can demonstrate that.
No, Sonny, you can't call in. Sorry. We'll have hopefully next week.
When I right-clicked on it to see if it would give me a choice to make a link, and it didn't do that either. There's no choice to make a link either. So that's, in my opinion, pretty much a complete failure. Of course, you know, the bottom line is that once you get really used to using, you know, the command line, it's really the purpose of a file manager becomes much, much less. There's just no way, no other way around it.
Well, I mean, I think it becomes nice with certain types of files, like image files. You know, if you can get a little preview of the image, can help you browsing around your image files, and I mean, you know, it's got some utility in that respect. But certainly, it's, you know, for text files, I'm not sure how much you gain by using a graphical file manager.
Well, even when I want to find files, it's easier just to type locate than it is to go searching for it visually. Is it much easier to query a database?
Well, you know, true, but you can't. We don't yet have the functionality to query a database for what something looks like. So, again, you know, or for what something sounds like, for that matter. So,
but that file manager is not going to help you with that either, is it?
Well, Nautilus.
Well, the best thing that Nautilus
does
was the capability of it to run music directly out of the music directory.
Right, which is, you know, pretty cool. And again, you get, you know, image thumbnails of all your image files, so you can see the image, you know, before you open it up in the GIMP or something like that.
Where is it? It's on the system somewhere. The other thing,
but
that, yeah,
I mean, you know, people have this real aversion to the command line interface, which I never really got. I mean, once you learn how to use it, you know, I find it hard to. I can't really work without it. I mean, I can't tell you how many times
he felt. Yeah, it was nothing more confining than the original Macintosh, where there was no command line interface. I mean, it's just it's enough to drive you nuts. Okay, so now we're turning it up. Of course, immediately takes over the desktop, turns over the name of the turns the background off. It took over my Genome desktop, and what else did it do? And here's another problem with it. Frankly, is it does look good. Actually, in this case, it runs pretty fast, but then, again, this computer is so damn... Sorry.
But the point I was going to make is even things like grep, you know? I mean, I don't know how many times that somebody, you know, in the web team that I work in, you know, wants to know how many files have a specific, link in them or something, you know? And,
right.
For me, it's a two-second operation. For them, they're opening up 20 files in Dreamweaver or something like that. And doing a find in each individual file.
Right.
I mean, it's crippling to not have these kind of tools. And not that you couldn't implement them graphically, I suppose, but they seem to have not. You know, they haven't translated from
the
command line culture.
They don't translate well
on
graphics because it's not a graphical kind of problem.
Yeah.
And that's where, you know, where the rubber hits the road, so to speak. Here we're... You guys obviously can't see this, but I just opened up Nautilus, as we said. And now, if we look up user local games, games is here. Games, there's nothing in there. Okay. How about?
No games, Ruben.
Bin?
All work and no play.
All work and no play. Don't bet on it. although there's clearly not as much play as I would like these days. Anybody who's interested in playing, call me, especially the female variety. My telephone number is 718-382-2772. It's also located on the web. I knew this radio would be good for something.
Hey, if we can't convince people to use free software, maybe we can get you laid, Ruben, right?
No,
or at least a date.
Drinks, yeah, dates would be okay.
At least dinner and dancing, maybe?
Hey, I'm really a good dinner date. Ask anybody who's ever done it. This funny thing is I used to have more dates when I was married than I do now. It's a very, very weird thing. Okay, so here is the... the client for Crossfire. If I try to drag that onto the desktop, it copies the whole file. Did you see that?
Yeah.
All right, that's idiotic. All right? In this case, at least it works. All right, when you click on it, at least it then works. Kill, go away. Kill? Yes. Okay. So, but then you figure, okay, maybe I can get it to link, right? So you right-click on it, and you look here for something, and there is no way of linking. There's copy and paste and cut. That's it. See, here it says make link. If you actually... So if you have it already in your desktop, then you can link it from one to the other. But if it's in Nautilus and you want to drag it onto your desktop, then you are shot. There's also this other annoying aspect of it that always bothered me, too, is like, there's move to trash. It's never just like delete the goddamn things because I don't want it anymore. That doesn't exist. But I guess what you can do. Well, no, you can't do that either. Yeah, see, if it's
you can just turn your trash into dev null, right?
If it's in Nautilus here, you see, there's just no way of actually linking it. And it doesn't even ask you, you know. Oh, here. Ah, look at that. Okay, so if you right click on it and you drag it over here, you can link it. Ah, look at
that. So you gotta jump through a couple hoops.
Okay, well, that's a hoop I guess I had never hit before. So, all right, so that's that, or it's actually an improvement in the code. So that's all right. But, of course, you know, on this machine, this whole thing runs just fine.
Well, that's true. Nautilus is a little bit of a resource hog.
That's an understatement. If you're running the news on it, then, you know, if you do a netstat, you find all kinds of neurosis on your netstat.
It opens a port or two that it maybe shouldn't.
Yeah. Well, you just keep praying that no... every day I wake up and I say, thank God there's no alerts on Nautilus yet. And so far we've been lucky in that regard. But there is, though, of course, the issue of, you know, the KDE file manager.
They're just using Conker, aren't they? Or, I mean, they went the Microsoft way, right? I mean,
Well, this is not much different than Microsoft way. Nautilus also has the capability to.
I guess that's true. That's true. Yeah, it's a web browser.
That's what I've been trying to say. This is very much like, what is it called? Windows Explorer. In fact, there you can see. Simple website done. In fact, it might even I don't know if it's got Gecko in it or there's nylx.com.
I think it's got Gecko because it's pretty heavily dependent on Mozilla stuff being.
I don't know. It could be. I'm not sure. It might be dependent on Gecko. I'm not certain. Although Conqueror is not. Conqueror doesn't depend on it. The thing is that Conqueror, though, is a very limited web browser, in my opinion. I mean, Rick Mullen in California thinks it's the greatest thing since Swiss cheese. I find that it doesn't do the things that I would like to do, even going back to Netscape 4. So that's my opinion. The new Opera is kind of nice. Again, that's a closed browser again. Let's just see how many things NetStat is running right now. Gee whiz, NetStat. Or TVEP. That's a minimum. Oh, let's do T also. Oh, we did T. Okay. So here you can see on this local system what's up and running with Conqueror or with NetStat open.
Nautilus open.
Actually, this is completely incorrect because this is in Marco's home machine. We got Marco's home machine. And you see, that's another thing it does, too. As soon as you open up Nautilus, you see that WinMaker, you lose your options on the WinMaker options.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, it does take over your desktop.
Yeah, when you right-click, it takes over your desktop on that. I was wondering. Okay. All right, this gives you an example of basically what's up and running. Just a few hundred things.
Oh, is that all?
Yeah. All right, so it's running something called IRDMI. Oh, that's actually Icecast. It's running Icecast, Icecast, MySQL, X, HTTPD, name, XChat, and here's Nautilus. Running right here on the TCP socket. Icecast, Icecast. This is also Nautilus. This is Icecast.
this is the X program that's running over there. Here's that's about it, the time being. But if you open up that news panel, and the more things that you put in that news panel,
Quickly
start getting all these, like every 20 minutes it tries to get out to the outside. And then if you have a slow machine, anytime it tries to do like a network interface like that, it just like brings your machine clearly almost to a halt. So at this point in juncture, I'd like to introduce our technical guru, Marco. Marco is going to talk to us about some of our future improvements that we hope to bring onto line, and some of the improvements that we have done now. And here you go.
So I'll take over Ruben's mic. We did add a mixer and a couple new mics this week, so I think the sound quality is better. We still have a problem that when you stream over the net, actually the dynamics, when people go from talking soft to talking loudly, it's very hard to
get the
levels right. I mean, because if I mean, most radio stations pass through what's called a compressor, which actually does, it reduces the dynamic range on what people are, on their voices. And I was out looking for a compressor that we could come ready built into a mixer, and this is something that is not sold anymore. It's all sold as double pieces of gear, so eventually we might get a compressor. I think it's probably essential for this type of project. But we've got some good equipment. And the more important than that is we're going to try to get the phone line, a phone patch, working so we can have call-in.
So you don't have to listen to...
which will... And also... I mean, we have multiple things that I should have gotten working and have not, because there's just lots of pieces to get this all going together. To get us to be able to play music and MP3s and sound effects and stuff mixed in with our own monotone... talking voices would certainly help.
You just told me we couldn't get too dynamic there, Marco. So you just said we couldn't get too dynamic, you know, because then it.
Well,
so we
when the file is already prepared, I mean,
we got to keep it real deadpan. You know?
What's difficult is, I mean, I should be sitting here just squatting the levels, and every time that somebody gets excited, turn the volume down, and every time somebody's talking very. Regularly, turn the volume up, which is basically what radio stations have. I mean, there's a.
An engineer sitting there.
There's a boy or whatever you have, like a whipping.
Just
sitting at the level.
Soundboard monkey.
Basically. Yeah, I mean, just sitting there and making them go up and down, which basically, I mean, they've tried to automate it, but haven't been able to automate the tracking of excitement of radio talk show hosts. The phone patch is a kind of a legal problem because tapping phone lines is illegal unless you have a search warrant, and that makes that type of equipment kind of fall under the same sort of difficulty of...
Can we get a search warrant for ourselves?
For ourselves? Yeah, I mean, the problem is I think that most companies that sell this sort of stuff, because it can be used for an illegal purposes, they have a lot of trouble, so it's kind of always like... You know, buying guns or something. I mean, it's like semi-illegal or semi-underground. It's heavily regulated, and it's hard. I mean, it's just hard to find now. Because I tried to do this before. Huh? We have a.
Well, I mean, if I throw my computer monitor at somebody's head that's using it illegally, wouldn't you say? I mean,
well,
you know, it's...
DMR.
Right,
you know,
yeah.
You buy a CD that you own, you can't actually own the information.
You're just sort of borrowing it from the record company.
Right, right. For $2.95 an hour. You know, this is gibberish.
Well, I mean, it's just criminal. It's a racket,
well,
you know.
It's not criminal because that's...
Well, it should be... I'm sorry, yeah. Let's put it this way. It should be criminal.
Know your rights, all three of them, okay? You have the right not to be killed, unless it's done by a policeman. You have the right to food money. If you don't mind being inspected and rejected and dejected and all things like that, right? And you have the right... What's the third one?
Well, there's 12
to pay taxes?
No, you have the right to... You have the right to food money. You have the right not to be killed.
I forget it. I'll have to go back and listen to The Clash again. I'm sure Billy's rolling right now because he would remember. We have that music here somewhere. Anyway, but
we'll get it online next week.
We'll get it online next week. From your mouth to God's ears, you're waiting for it.
Yeah, so the phone patch, we'll get it eventually, but it's not for now. We could try some tricky internet thing if you have a broadcast. I mean, we could maybe, you know, do some sort of like repeating the stream.
Voice over IP.
Somebody else. The way we're broadcasting, they could broadcast to us, and we could probably figure out how to.
Oh, sure, yeah.
I mean, rewrap that stream into our stream, but that would. Well, no, with all the 7-second delays, that would be a major nightmare.
We could probably just hack the phone in and grab the analog sound line and dump it into, like, a sound card or something, right?
The problem with the phone line is that, I mean, when I tried to do this, and I actually tried to build a patch by, like, getting the circuits off the internet and everything, and it's actually difficult because the analog phone lines, and we should get David Sugar in on this because he certainly knows a lot more about this than I do, have, a 90-volt potential difference across them, or it's a very high potential difference, actually.
Oh, that's a good point, Sonny. We'll take a look at that.
And, I mean, so it's like analog electronic-wise, there is it's a slightly heavier duty stuff than you get. And the thing I did had so much freaking noise in it, in the circuit, that it was absolutely unusable. Now, could have been many problems, but...
In any event, we're working on getting the phone patch so we can, you guys can, all 300 of you guys can participate a little, you know, more actively.
Might be able to jig the back so that we can run a party line of the whole neighborhood. We just get everybody's, personal phone calls on streaming over the net.
And well, with we doing the ice, like another server receiving a bunch of feeds, and then we could.
We can just wire, you know, this the main switch right in the corner from the house, which is what DSL is so good over here. And what we can do is then just.
We just hop into people's conversations and say, hey, what do you think about free software?
Why did gibbering and talking about their mothers, their daughters, and their mistresses? And then we can just like say, you know, by the way, that thanks to free software, this is now being announced.
I don't know if that's the way to make
FBI
friends.
Down here in about 2 seconds. But yeah, otherwise it's a great idea.
Well, there was a time where I had a crossfire like that on the phone system, and there's a girl on the phone.
I don't think anyone can hear Ruben. He's trying to get in on this discussion, but...
I went and turned his mic down.
There was a time where I had a cross wire like that on the phone system, and there was... The other people that were on the line refused to cooperate with me in trying to figure out where it was, and the phone company kept denying that it is in existence. So finally, I pick up the phone one time, and this girl wants to get a cab. And she goes... I listened to her make the entire order for the cab. She's going, blah, 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 the Williamsburg, whatever. They make the whole deal, and then I said, you know what? Forget it. We're not going. And I hung up really hard. And I picked the phone back up. And I pick it up. Now she's squabbling with the guy. She goes, no, we're still going. I said we're not going. If you send that cab, I'm telling you, nobody's going to come in down for that cab. It's going to be a complete waste of time. And she goes, you know, this is ridiculous. I said, that's it. No cab. The guy goes, you two work it out, and I will, and call me back if you want the cab. And the result was that she goes, I said, now finally, tell me who the hell you are, because we've been having a cross line for 3 months. She goes, are you planning on doing this for the rest of the time that we're cross like this? I said, you damn straight I am. And so we finally
you need someone else
problem.
To complain with you.
It's wound up being my landlord upstairs, and it took only 10 minutes after that to fix the problem. So we're looking forward to doing that. We can cross-wire the entire block and just, you know, dip into people's conversations if we can get that phone patch.
Yeah, I don't know. Where were we in this discussion?
You're telling us about all the great things that we're going to be able to do with our, with our radio show.
Yeah.
That's it?
Well,
I shouldn't say that's it, but that's...
I think it would be interesting to get a little library of sort of sound events. Like, most radio shows do have, punctuation things. I mean, it doesn't have to be stupid, but it could be stupid too. But Joe, you had a lot of ideas about kind of programming ideas which we could use to make this a little bit like have little segments or editorial comment come into the middle or something. Bring a little bit more structure.
Yeah, we're hoping to maybe structure the format a little bit more and maybe we can hopefully make this educational, provocative, and entertaining all at the same time. I think is our end goal here.
Well, we've got 400 clients. That seems good enough.
All from your DSL. Cranking them out.
That's right. I'm making fun of my DSL.
I'm not making fun of your DSL.
You guys are just jealous.
We just think you have a little bit more faith in your DSL than...
I've never thought that DSL, ever. And when it happens...
We're hoping that all you listeners out there will help us tap out Ruben's DSL
when
connection.
When it happens, I'll be very happy to see it. When it finally happens. You killed the panel?
I didn't kill any panels.
Oh, it's gone.
So, what do we have upcoming this week? What are our events
this
week?
Yeah, that was the next thing that I wanted to bring up. First of all, for everybody that's listening, and I know there's hundreds of you out there, you should know that the Free Software Institute is going to be gearing up again this week, right? So, starting theoretically when? Tuesday?
There's Perl starting Tuesday, and Linux is starting Wednesday.
Linux 1.
Linux 1.
Do we have plans? Have we made the plans yet for Linux 2? Because that's the next step. We have a number of people, I think, that are ready for that, right?
I think that a number of the people that were interested in Linux 2 are in the process of taking Perl 2 and didn't want to take two classes at the same time.
Okay, so the Perl 2 class should be done in about 3 weeks.
Right, so then I think Linux 2 should pick up
okay,
when those guys are direction. Free to get to take... Because they were saying that two classes at the same time was a bit more than their poor little brains could handle.
Well...
I think it probably schedules too.
Huh? Well, maybe families and other things like that. But
well, people are going on vacation, of course.
I mean, we highly recommend that everyone take advantage of the classes we're offering. I took one and learned a great deal from it, as a matter of fact.
In fact,
and
you kept your fucking job.
That's right. And that's right, yeah.
Your job was teetering until I took your
Yes. Oh, I'm I lost my train of thought there.
Lost your train of thought.
You cut me off, Ruben. Yeah.
There you go.
Our little multitasking environment will keep an eye on chat and keeping a discussion going. And
it's true.
We're gonna get the hang of it.
Anybody who is listening to this who has only mucked around with Linux to a point and loaded Mandrake or something like that and is trying to learn how to use it, I really highly recommend, even if you're never planning on doing any hacking with it, to take the Linux 1 class. It's really the class that you need in order to feel sufficient with the operating system. You probably will never learn with the graphic user interfaces any longer how the systems work underneath the hood fundamentally. And, of course, I learned basically how these systems work underneath the hood fundamentally when I originally learned how to install DOS, and you actually had to format the hard drive and so on in order to do the installation. Most people don't have a clue as to anymore what's on their computers. And really, if you're going to run with any operating system, I would recommend that you take enough, you will learn enough about the OS to understand how it basically functions underneath. Even if it is a proprietary operating system, but clearly if it's a free operating system, you should take advantage to learn it. And it's not that hard.
Well, there's so many tools there that you would never know about unless somebody presented them to you.
We have such great fun with it anyway. Yeah. Really, it's a fun class. You know. Also, I don't know how to do it, but I also encourage more minorities and more women to take the class. So all you women out there, take the class. We treat women respectfully and without any sliding sex jokes or anything like that. You get... treated well, so you have to worry about being geeked in the classroom, because that's not going to happen. Not why I'm teaching anyway, or why I'm running the program. In addition to that, minorities, it's a really big thing. We're trying to, of course, we have a whole minority program that we're trying to put together to try to get more free software into minority neighborhoods and impoverished neighborhoods, even to not minority neighborhoods. To decrease the level of disenfranchisement in general. So, you should look possibly for that. Also, if you are coming from one of those communities, or either or any of those communities. We also are, hopefully by next month, also going to have the desktop program up and running. And I'm quite excited about the prospect of doing that, actually. And I suppose that class is going to fill up quickly, because nobody else is doing this
currently, and we will be the first when we break new ground. And there's a huge groundswell of need for it, and people are curious about it. So we hope to have an open office and general X desktop class up and running by, I would say, mid-July, probably after July 4th. Other announcements is, first of all, if you want to get our announcements, they are usually on the front page of www.nylxs.com, and I would ask anybody who has events that they want to put on for the community to fill out the form that's on that website to make your announcements and put the stuff on our calendar. And every day before an event takes place, a reminder goes out from our calendar system to the announcements list to let people know what's happening tonight and the day after that. So that's generally been pretty cool. Okay. I believe that Deluge is doing something this week also. I don't recall off the top of my head.
We should have another Install Fest coming up shortly.
Yes, we're going to have another drinking session soon. that will probably be in 2 weeks.
But we do also get desktops installed, you know, or we do get Linux installed on machines.
Yes, before we break them over each other's heads.
What's Cassandra's address?
There's also...
You want to look at Cassandra's as long as you're telling everybody about ours? It's no problem.
You said Deluge is doing something.
Deluge, yes. It's on our website.
Good.
Look up events. Or, for that matter, just slide down. And look at the calendar. Okay, look up. If it's not on the calendar, it's not there. Okay. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe next month that he's doing it. Okay, in any event. Nylog's meetings are coming up probably soon also.
Every third Wednesday?
Every third Wednesday.
Or every third Wednesday of the month.
There's the YX open source SIG.
Yes, that's the one I want to discuss. The WWAC, the World Wide Web Artist Consortium, due to broad efforts by Jay Salzberg and Marco Stuffy. Is having decided that instead of hearing us constantly bother them, they're going to have a program for open source software, and that information should be available on the WAX list, which is www.wwwac.org. So that's there also. I expect that all our NYLXS people should be there to haggle and harass them appropriately.
Heckle, the site they're reviewing is called heck.com, so...
There you go, okay.
We'll just add a L-E and...
Okay, there you go. Alright, that's good, too.
Educational heckling, you know, not just
yes,
annoying.
Yes, of course.
Empowering and...
Constructive heckling is what we're about.
Open-minded heckling.
In addition to that, there's also coming our dinner, which will probably be scheduled for mid-July, and we're going to be getting information about that out in the coming week, hopefully. And we're hoping for a cruise, so if you want to take a boat ride out into the water, obviously, because where else would you take a boat ride into, but into the Atlantic Ocean or into New York Harbor, we hope to arrange to have a nice dinner, and I think that we'll get a decent speaker, probably Richard Stallman, if I had to guess, and we're looking... perhaps at like $250 a seat for that dinner. And the reason why we're charging so much money for this is because it's for our building fund. NYLXS is trying to get its building and so that we can have a permanent place for teaching our classes, perhaps open up an internet cafe with using free software, either in downtown Brooklyn or downtown Manhattan. And
I think we should mention, too, though, that once we do get our space, that we'll be, we will... make that space available to the community at large.
Yes, completely.
So, you know, by contributing to us getting a building, you're
contributing to the broader community, without a doubt. And it'll give people actually, and this has been a problem. We'll be able to afford to give a resource, I'm sorry, to many of the groups to be able to do this. Of course, we have the deputy commissioner of the New York Liquor Authority in our organization, so we should be able to serve beer,
wine and sangria, and so this is also coming up in the coming month. Did I leave anything out now?
I think you covered it. I think that's...
You never cover all of it, somehow.
Oh, yes, and one last thing I want to talk about. Okay, hang on. Before I... do you guys know about the fair use bill?
Yeah.
What do you know about it?
That it has been started and needs to be continued.
Well, I think what you know, Ruben's probably more driving at is how we need to, what we need to do is instead of the current legal situation in which fair use is regarded as an exception to copyright, we need to really flip that around and redefine copyright to be an exception to fair use. And what this will do
originally
will. And if we're successful in doing this, the burden then is on the accuser to prove that the defendant in that case would not have been exercising their fair use rights. So instead of just what that does is it switches the it shifts the burden of proof from the defendant to the plaintiff, to use I guess the legal jargon, and. So rather than, what often happens now is that, you know, there's a lot of scare tactics and intimidation used where people threaten to slap copyright lawsuits on you. And then it's left to the person being accused to prove that they were, in fact, not violating copyright. And if we are successful in passing a fair use bill, that burden will shift, and then it will be up to the person accusing of copyright violation to prove that that person in fact was not exercising their fair use rights.
Okay. We have actually a specific proposal that's on the table that we're trying to find a lawyer to write up for us, and this has been a problem. If you are a lawyer or if you know a lawyer and you want to help us with a bill, we do have a bill that we're trying to produce that has six basic points that it's trying to go over, and I'll give you those points in a second. Now the problem trying to do a bill like this is that despite that we did it, and I did write it up, we find that there is even with what I thought was a fairly well written or well thought out agenda, we did run into questions and problems, and let me just go over what some of those problems are, and also what we originally proposed. First of all, we originally proposed this bill for it to be picked up by Jean Thewell. Now, Jean Thewell is a friend of mine, and who has been involved with several of our efforts in terms of NY fair use. And NY fair use was an organization which was started a little bit before this one got off the ground, and what it does is it's involved with trying to focus specifically on the issues of fair use in the current environment. And
I guess maybe we should clarify what fair use actually is.
Go ahead. Clarify away.
I think you know, Ruben probably has this down a little better than I do, but I'll give it a go and let him fill in the gaps. So essentially, fair use is a set of rights guaranteed by the First and Fourth Amendment. And for those of you that were not paying attention in high school history class, or probably earlier than that, your First Amendment, of course, guarantees your right to, among other things, free speech. And your Fourth Amendment guarantees your rights to your personal property. And so what that means, how that translates into to using something like your CD, is that, you know, you own the physical CD. It is your property. And by virtue of that, you have the right to do certain things with it. Namely, you know, you can pop it into your computer. You can rip those songs off it and turn them into MP3s and listen to them on your MP3 player or through your computer or whatever other means you want. And this is because that is your private property and you own it and you are free to do with it what you please. And so at the moment, though, these fair use rights are
under assault.
Yeah, that's right.
Or plain and simple.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I guess that's about the simplest way to put it. So, you know, what we're trying to do here, or a large part of our work, is making sure that these fair use rights are not stripped from you, and that you'll be guaranteed, or that they will be guaranteed to you, and that you will be able to use the information, or, you know, I guess to put it in the most general way, that, you know, you will be able to continue to make use of and enjoy in a free way, you know, media content, music, movies, scientific research. You know, it's really kind of frightening, you know, because if you step back a little and you say, well, you know, what if the same sort of legislation were trying to be passed, you know, when I don't know, somebody like Newton was doing their scientific work. I mean, all of modern physics might be copyrighted and would be, you know, high school children would be charged to learn it, you know, because somebody would hold a copyright for it. You know, I think it's pretty evident that culturally, technologically, you know, we've advanced by building upon the work of previous generations. Or not even just generations, but
what is a generation? Is even
or yeah. So that, I mean, the notion of a generation, yeah, that's even pointless. I mean, it's just straightforward is building upon the work of others and extending it and synthesizing it new ways to be able to create new and original works. And if you take that away, you in essence you're stunting technological and cultural development. And you know, it creates nothing less than a you know modern dark ages here. Where, you know, I mean, it's really sort of sad in a way when you were standing on the brink of one of the most interesting times in humanity when, you know, this mass communication has been made available to us, and it really sort of there's a lot of opportunity promised in that. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. The cost of copying information has been reduced to nothing. So.
And that's the number one thing they want to block, and that's what's incredible about the information revolution in the first place.
Right. Right.
Well, think about what it's meant in economically. What do you think? What do you think the internet has made to the economy? You know, like in the previous decade, how much of an engine has it been? In driving the economy at this point?
Well, it's enormous, even if you factor in, I think, for the sort of dot-com bubble bursting. I mean, you know, that's going to end up being small potatoes compared to what it'll really do.
It's not like the entire dot-com...
Yeah, that's right. I'm not sure that it's measurable. I mean, how much knowledge and research is then sort of reappropriated into private enterprise? You know, it's I'm not even sure that you could adequately measure something like that. And we're in a position now where basically you know Congress and big business would have technology and culture sort of stopped in their path so that we can prop up these antiquated business models. You know, I mean, it is not the burden of the American citizen to keep these sort of outmoded business models in place. I mean, it's up to business to readjust. I mean, you know, people understand this implicitly. This is why Napster is so big. I mean, the fact is that, you know, information is not like a car or a house. You know, it's not a physical piece of property. It's, and you know, I mean, a CD is something that carries information is, but the information itself is, you know, it doesn't, it just simply doesn't fit in quite nicely with, you know, some of the sort of business models that exist now. And what they're really trying to do is do anything they can to keep it fitting into that. And you know, I mean, and I guess, you know, this is sort of nature of things. There's always a preference for the status quo, and change is difficult, but you know, we this is why we need to be so diligent in our fight here to maintain our fair use rights. Because literally the freedom, you know, we're talking about our children, our freedom, our children's freedom, to interact with information and to empower themselves by such is really being threatened here.
Do you think that even with the dot bubble bursting, with the dot-com bubble bursting, that there is still a future for economic growth dealing with the fair use of material and electronic media?
You know, I think of course, you know, there's always, I mean, it might require some creativity on the part of the people trying to develop business models around that, but you know, I think that already, you know, people have said that they would pay for things like subscription services and so forth. So, and, you know, that's something off the top of my head, and I think sort of off the top of everyone else's head, it was sort of the first thing that occurred to them. You know, so it's going to take a little while, and there'll be a sort of evolution, you know, and how it is that, you know, you'll build a business around producing content alone and not necessarily the CD that it comes on or the magazine that it comes, that it's, or, you know, the paper that it's printed on. So, you know, I don't know if, so again, you know, there's things like subscription services and, I don't know, you have any ideas, Marco? Anything else ever occur to you how people would make money off of it?
I mean, but I think it's going to take more than 2 years to figure it out.
Well, that's right, yeah, yeah. I mean, you can't.
I mean, that's the, you know, why anyone would imagine that in 6 months they could figure out, you know, the revolution and make the tons of money on it. When does this ever happen? And it takes more than 6 months. It might take, you know, 10 or 15 years for the business models to get worked out. But the point is, don't start squashing them now before they've even happened.
Well, right, right. And especially
start
do not...
putting regulations on them now. It's going to take much more than 10 or 15 years.
Right, right. And the point is, you can never sacrifice, you know, civil liberties. And it really comes down nothing less to your civil liberties. You know, you cannot sacrifice them to sort of make sure that, you know, BMI or Atlantic can keep selling CDs or that, you know, Disney can keep selling, you know, videotapes. I mean, it's just, you know, that is certainly not the most desirable outcome for, you know, frankly, humanity in general, to not sound too grandiose about this whole thing. But
I've seen a lot of those, the Jack Valenti quotes on VHSs from 10 or 15 years ago where he's saying, the VHS is going to destroy the...
Well, that, yeah, I mean, that's the funniest thing. And
I mean, it's so proven not to be the case.
I mean, it's bigger than it ever was.
You know, and then VHS sales account for something like 46% of all revenue for any movie
that's right,
that comes
out.
And now you see the VHS sale getting, you know, television advertisements, just the way the actual movie ticket sales get television advertisements. And you know, I mean, you just have to adapt your business model that, you know,
right,
most
yeah.
people in the U.S. watch the movies on video or in a re-recorded form than in the much more expensive going to the actual cinema.
That's right. You know, but the point is that, you know, the consumer will sort of I mean, the market will direct what is the appropriate business model. You know, and I think, you know, that's, you brought up kind of an interesting point. I mean, everybody sort of wants this to take care of itself overnight, and it's just not going to happen. I mean, it's going to, there's really going to be some growing pains, and there's, you know, I mean, anybody probably with a little foresight could have predicted that, you know, we would see all these dot-coms go out of business because, you know, I mean,
it becomes very clear now that we know that we cannot even depend on our stockbrokers to give us real information, as has been coming out in the last few weeks.
Oh, well, yeah, I guess this is true, too. I mean, I guess even that aside.
I mean, one point that I, as a sort of, I mean, I'd like to be a content provider somewhere, and the one point that always kind of gets bypassed is the sort of dream that Napster or these massive distribution systems could have created for the artist looking for a venue to express himself or looking for a way of getting the work out there. With the internet as a two-way street, which is becoming less and less and less of a two-way street every single moment. I mean, every single contract you ever buy, oh, it's because the client wants to download more than he wants to upload. Oh, you know, the client doesn't really need his, his own domain for his own email and all sorts of things. And all the internet service providers are perfectly willing to limit the freedom of the internet,
and that's the thing, you know.
That's why on the bottom of my emails, I don't know if you're seeing, I'm always saying they want to turn the internet into cable TV.
That's right.
And cable TV is their image. It's just feeding you this content and these ads that they are in complete control of.
And see what kind of nightmare that's become over the last few weeks.
Yeah, so,
specifically when there's been this hot conversation on FAN, which is a local sports station, about the Yankees, who are owned by George Steinbrenner, who also basically owns the YES Network. And Cablevision, who owns, who actually leases from the city the cables that present the material for the Yankees, half the city is being blanked out of Yankee games because of this problem. And while people are complaining about this and discussing it and complaining and yanking about it, what they fail to really focus on, which is the big problem, which is. The big problem is that there has to be a fundamental right to access to information in the first place. In fact, we do have that right. It's built into the Fourth Amendment, so as we've been saying.
But not to mention that this is something our founding fathers knew implicitly. I mean, was it Benjamin Franklin is the one who started libraries in this country, right? I mean,
there was a big battle over libraries and public education, because who wants to teeter troll those Irish and WOP kids,
Ruben's trying to get me incited here.
why should that become the responsibility of the public? Like, the hell with that, right? You know, and we had this battle once. And it was done in the 1820s, and here we are.
But I mean, I completely, like, ideologically, completely agreed. But I do think that there's a technical point where it's possible to create a web-like distribution system as opposed to the star-based distribution system, which has a cable or media empire at the node of the star serving out the information to anyone who wants to pay for it.
What's
right?
A node?
A node on a network model is a point of transaction. So if you picture like the hub of a wheel with a central person in the middle, as like your cable TV provider has always been, and you only have the choice of buying whatever content the cable TV provider decides to put on his net. If you look at the beginning of cable television, at the very, very beginning, there were all sorts of dreams of, oh my God, every single neighborhood's going to have its own broadcasting center, and we can have local news like down from the corner store, and all sorts of dreams that are very similar to this sort of internet, beginning of the internet dream, where it's like, oh, everybody can have their web page, all this information can go out as a two-way model. I mean, this is a kind of dream of a community speaking out without always having somebody else making the decision of what news is worthy or what movie is important to see this weekend will get sold to you, because they have control of the distribution channels. And unless we come out, I mean, that's why I push so strongly to rebroadcast these streams, to push the idea, to get people used to the idea of creating these webs, because it's the only way that the community could possibly come up with a distribution network that's anywhere near as strong as the distribution network that some huge media empire can pay for.
I mean,
because no individual's ever going to have that kind of money. Whereas 10,000 people, that's why Napster is such a big word. That's why Napster struck the fear.
Napster's
in the media
also
Napster can deliver far more content than we ever.
Actually, I'd like to bring up the case of Napster for a second. The case of Napster is very interesting. You know, Napster this week declared Chapter 11, and it's in bankruptcy court. Now, Napster is actually proof positive that we do not need, under any circumstances, anything like the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, even to enforce current copyright law as it exists in its insane state. What put Napster out of business was not DMR or preventing people from access to their information. What put Napster out of business was conventional court orders and fighting copyright abuse, and hence Napster is gone.
But had Napster, had there been no company involved with Napster, and that somewhere the
name, you don't need a company like Nutella, right? I mean, Nutella
never has gotten the name recognition that Napster has gotten. Right? The only thing that brought Napster down was that somewhere there were centralized servers trafficking copyrighted information. Whereas if it had remained a completely distributed network, like no one has ever really seen a completely distributed network of a very, very high number of nodes. But which is imaginable.
Which is going to become very hard.
Napster would never have been brought down. And
but the reason that, but you know, this supports your other point about, you know,
Napster
ISPs
had a business model, though.
Yeah, I mean, there was a company
that's illegal. That's right.
But you know what you're, but what
that's
you're
what made Napster illegal.
If
you know,
there has never
but
been
that's what made Napster illegal.
Right.
You can't make a business model on somebody else's intelectual.
Right.
I hate
if there's
to
never been a company mixed
you know
up
intellectual monopolies.
Phase, I mean, there wasn't necessarily a need to be these centralized servers, right? There was not necessarily a need to be this image, except that Nutella's never gotten the name recognition.
No, I've tried using it.
You know?
No, I've tried using it. It sucks.
Well, that's well frankly, that's
it's harder to find things in Nutella than it was in Napster because it wasn't centralized.
Because it is decentralized,
right?
And it comes back.
It's wandering around.
Marco, it comes back to your problem of
limited the dark.
Upload pipes. You know, is really why Nutella is not.
It's not just that. It's wandering around the dark. And it really it is.
But a lot of cases you see a beginning of a free model of the software is never up to the same level as whatever company-driven software model is. But after 3 or 4 years, you go, Jesus, you know, the GIMP has come around, you know.
No, there is no model like this, though. The problem here with Nutella is that it's completely decentralized. As you said, there's no central repository for an index, which was what made Napster work. It's much easier to do this with a centralized framework than it is wandering around trying to.
That's right. Nutella has.
And then you have, yeah, half the time you try
these super servers.
Half the time when you try to hit Nutella sites, you know, the site's down, it's not there. The site's moved, stuff's moved. I mean, I had MP3s on my server, and I had to move them because people flooded my. And suddenly they were discovered. God knows who discovered them, and suddenly my machine was flooded, and it would bring down my ability to access the net to a halt. So I had to move all my MP3s. Not offline, they moved them to a different location. So they couldn't find them, and that happens a lot with Nutella. And, of course, one of the things that Napster did that helped in this regard was that they prevented, they moved the load around so that everybody wouldn't be hitting the same five guys all day long.
But it's also, I mean, it is possible to have these type of systems built into a distributed network. I mean, it would just have to come in. I mean, it would have to be programmed and have to exist, you know?
It wouldn't matter. A centralized server where a business model will be there, including the marketing that's involved in it, will still be mostly used by kids or even by adults, because, you know, you can easily go to that site, pick the stuff up without a hassle, pick it up, and download a quality rip of the music onto your hard drive. And people, I think, are willing to pay, actually, for that service. And the music companies, the fact that they don't want to implement that is neither here or there. But the bottom line is that Napster didn't put the music business out of business. That's number one.
They actually increased it by all.
It may not have.
Well, I
don't
guess
care
link
enough
link
to look, frankly.
But you know, I think. Decided. I mean, if you have something like Napster, the music companies have less control over what is actually popular. You know, so they lose a certain ability to push.
And that's,
upon
I mean, that's
you
the
certainly.
Biggest fear. A rock band could make it without ever coming under the grips of a music company. You know, without ever having to sign a recording contract, the rock bands become really famous and sell out big concerts without ever signing a contract. And that, and for the music company, is the biggest fear ever, you know? Or, like, the independent label could actually have a humongous hit.
I think I agree that is probably, it's probably,
I mean, you can't, you know, do market forecasts.
Yeah, you can't do a market forecast on something as quicksand as a Napster user base. You know, I mean, you just can't. And that's when the moment you see, I can't pay radio stations to play this song and up the sales of this new CD I'm trying to sell. No, you can't, because people make actual decisions. It's not like cable television where you have no decision whatsoever except changing the channel. You actually make the decision to, like, on the kind of pay-per-view model or something. I mean, which would completely, you know, which videotapes get rented most or something is a different.
See, but this is, you know, the great thing they're sort of missing about what, even from a business standpoint, what's so great about a distribution mechanism like Napster, because you can actually track how many people are downloading your songs. You know,
you can directly modify it indirectly through, I mean, advertisements or other.
But I mean, through the radio, stations may be playing it, but
I mean, they're probably just going to start paying people to host their MP3 or whatever.
Well, that's the best part is that they actually do.
Model, you know, just the way somebody pays for you to put a banner ad on your site, they'll be like, "Hey, we'll pay for you to put the number one hit on your page to be a, you know, Celine Dion, whatever, la di da."
Well, yeah, that's the great thing, is that they actually do, at this moment, use, you know, they actually do pay. Well, you know, things have changed in the radio industry, too, but traditionally they have paid,
They do pay to have songs play. I mean, the recording company pays the radio to play certain songs.
More so now than they used to, even, because they always did. But there's a definite change.
I mean, since the
there's a change.
You know,
no, there's
I
been.
I don't know when, but I mean, it's definitely, you know.
Yeah.
Since the beginning of pop star and that kind of media icon person, it's definitely. I mean, radio stations have been paid to play certain songs a number of times.
There's been a change in the way the radio stations are, though, because the radio stations are no longer mom-and-pop-owned enterprises.
Well, that's
and
another
so
cataclysm of media in the last 10 years.
Well,
that's right. And the FCC actually just, not in radio, but in television anyway, I know, just lifted a regulation allowing, you know, networks to own more stations in their actual home market and, you know, basically...
Well, in radios there was massive consolidations because it became very easy to host a number of stations in the same building and pre-record shows and save them digitally and have them go out. Like a DJ would come in for 1 hour in the morning and be paid for an hour and do all the spots for the entire day, which are then split up because it's very easy to manipulate the files digitally. And then they could rebroadcast this same DJ, you know, Tom in the morning from Chicago is actually the same Tom in the morning all the way to, you know, Indianapolis and hits the entire Midwest, and then there are no more mom and pops around anymore because these radio stations can undersell everybody else and can, you know, and then
there was an economy of scale. Right, yeah.
I mean, there was a massive consolidation in the radio broadcasting companies, and this consolidation ended up having very often in towns you actually have all the radio stations in the same building belong owned by the same person with four or five, you know, they have their country thing,
yeah,
and
they're almost all owned by Infinity
thing, and they're all owned by the same people, and you guys have, you know, I've noticed the quality of radio go down the tubes in the last 10 years, you know, and many, you know, excellent stations disappear because they can't
when you have to listen to college radio now if you want anything cutting edge or decent.
Yeah.
What's cutting edge?
Like, not paid for by huge media companies.
So if you want to listen to anything besides the Backstreet Boys, Blink 182, or Britney Spears.
Well, yeah, they've actually had, the consolidation, from what I understand, has actually had an impact on the business, in that the music companies are now actually being forced by the large radio companies to produce knockoffs to the current sound, so that the record companies actually lost control. And this is what I was reading. Actually, it was in the Wall Street Journal or was in the Weekly Business News this morning, but that the radio companies are now in such a driving seat in terms of delivering the music content that they're demanding basically that the companies to be even more conservative than they would normally be. Because if they have a hit, they want to play that hit, and they will only take, and they're actually literally demanding music that sounds just like the stuff that's a hit. So you have...
It's like marketing team control.
But, you know, we probably shouldn't leave MTV out of this, too. You know, they probably more than radio now influence the consumer preference in the music market.
But you definitely hear coming out of TV and radio stations... Our business is selling ads. And then, you know, maybe 20 years ago, the guy would never have dared to say that. You know, their business is selling as many ad spots as they possibly can, and they figure out however many ways to sell ads. And before, they'd say, our business is delivering the great content that America loves to see, you know? And I'm sorry, but you feel it.
solutions?
Distributed local broadcasting networks.
That's right, decentralization.
Like we're getting off the ground. Just people getting fed up and saying, you know,
I mean, having a real market, not a contrived market, you know, or as close as you can get to a real market. A real sort of ecosystem, you know, where you have real selection.
It's really unfortunate we don't have a call-in right at this moment.
Well, you know, one of the things, I'm kind of stalling a little bit in case it's not obvious,
but I don't think your mail is called fair use, though. It was a response to another, you forwarded over from another list. If you looked up response, I think you'd come up with some stuff. Because I remember I emailed you back with response.
15, 16. Okay. That's the one I just looked at. No. All right. This basically, it's basically six. The fair use bill is basically a six-part proposal. The first part is that that there should be a return back to the artist of literature and music scores. And when I mean literature, I mean literature. You know, not source code, which in itself has to be cleaved off as its own subcategory for copyright purposes, because somehow things get mixed up. And literature should be given back to the artists, and music scores and recordings back to the original artist after 10 years. The second point to the bill that we had was that a statement that fair use is to be defined as an extension of the normal property rights of individuals to their property under the First and Fourth Amendment of the Constitution. In the third amendment to the Fair Use Bill was that companies nor government can do anything to obstruct the normal use of individuals to their copyrighted materials that they own. That didn't come out to sound like it meant. But what that means is that the purpose of this is to say that if you own something that's a CD or a DVD, that the company cannot do anything that obstructs your normal use of that item.
Like encrypting it?
Yes, by encrypting it. Encrypting itself is not a problem, but encrypting it and then demanding that you have to buy something from them to read it, that's not allowed. Right? That's theft. Right? The other thing, we also wanted to define in the bill that anything that does that is considered stealing from the public and or from the individuals itself. Another point that we tried to cover in the fair use bill is that any copyright violation that is being pursued by any company has to prove that the use was not a fair use of the material. That would basically eliminate a whole truckload of problems. But the first thing it would do is it would say that if, example, that somebody goes over and they decrypt something so they can read it on their GNU systems, that that act of decrypting it and even making that public knowledge is not a copyright violation. It's a fair use violation, and you would not be able to successfully sue somebody unless you actually proved that that action is not just a copyright violation, but actually not a normal fair use of that item by the individual. We also have put into the into this law, we're proposing that there is a wiretapping for computers
segment, which would basically say that at no time can anybody build anything into a standard computer operating system or digital device, anything that would give personal information off that device without the owner's express agreement to do so. The next part of the bill then goes on to say that no license under copyright is valid unless it is negotiated fairly by both parties with a signed signature under a notary, which would basically invalidate most licenses that most things are given under, which is something that we would like to do. Now, that's something that affects a lot of people in a lot of ways. But the bottom line here is that what it tries to do is it tries to say that if you give something under a copyright, under a copyright agreement, you know, you give it to them, first of all, they own it because it's theirs, right? They purchased it, they legally acquired it, it's their property. It's not any longer the property of the person who sold it. But in addition to that, what it says is that you can't enforce any contract on that individual in the normal course of a cash sale of that, and this has to do with cash sales, by the way. You can't have any cash sale which implies anything more than the normal commercial transaction of a cash sale. So you can't tell somebody that they can only play this DVD in their bedroom but not the living room. You can't tell them that they can only play it in Brooklyn and not in France, although I am all for keeping things out of France.
What's wrong with France?
Don't worry, the DVD region codes.
It's good. I'm also approve keeping things out of French out of New York. But you start with the Statue of Liberty, actually. But anyway,
they don't want our stuff either. So
that's right. In any event, which I promised I wouldn't say on the show anymore, that was that was another aspect of it. Of all the aspects of it that were written up, the one that annoyed most the Eben Moglen, who is the chief attorney for the FSF, what worried him the most was the part of the bill which returned back to the artist after 10 years the material that they created. And he's worried because then the Free Software Foundation would lose its copyright control of, or its assignment of, a large percentage of the original GNU project. And they're worried that this would be considered, that there would be no way of cleaving legally the source code from literature. But I say this is gibberish, flat out. All right? We can clearly create a law that says that source code is not literature, and literature is literature, because literature means something plainly in English, and that doesn't include source code. So I don't see any problem here, and we shouldn't have this problem.
I think he does bring up the point that we do have to legally differentiate.
Yes, we have to make sure this is clear.
I mean, it is a consideration.
Yes, it is something that has to be cleared. Also, we'll probably have to look at issues of things that are made by multiple people for sale. Or under contract. So, like, if 15 people are working on something, 20 people are working on something, who has copyright? Who has the copyright of a large musical production? Is it the whole choir plus the engineers? I mean, they all were involved in the making of it. Who has actually copyright control of it? And so, but in software, it becomes a bigger problem because you may have 1,000 software producers working on a single single project, and then who owns the original copyright? It's not really doable for software anyway because of the nature of the way software is produced. But it is something that has to be anyway, let me just say that I will repost the original points back on the NYLXS Hangout mailing list tonight or tomorrow. I want you to look forward to it. And then and what we really need is we need some help drafting this bill and getting it to Washington. And the sooner we can get it to Washington, the better off we'll all be. Because the thrust of this bill is to redefine the basic premise of fair use and copyright. And what it will do is it will give the EFF has no way of winning any of the lawsuits that we're looking at of any significance, because the legal jargon that they're using in order to handle these problems is stacked against them. What this bill is designed explicitly is to turn that jargon around and to empower the lawyers again so that they were actually able to defend our fair use rights. Because when you really come down to it, the whole problem with copyright is not the copyright. We don't care about the copyright, DMCA, whatever. All these laws have, they all become subjugated to fair use
if they're all subjugated to fair use properly because of our constitutional amendments, because we're explicitly stating in law that our constitutional amendments is what fair use is, then the courts have no choice because the legislation is saying that fair use is an extension, Congress's intention to extend the fundamental premises of property rights and freedom of speech in vis-a-vis its natural antagonism with copyright. And this is probably the most important thing in NYLXS or any other organization could probably do in the following year, and I hope that we really gear up to do this. Of course, we need to be funded to do this, so please take classes. We need to be get the word out about it. We need to get some lawyers on board, obviously, and we're going to need to do some door knocking this summer. And I beg you, I mean, I really do beg you guys, if you care about your future at all, if you care about your lives with free software, or your ability to use a public library in the future, or to sing happy birthday to your children, all right, in a public space. You can't go to McDonald's and sing happy birthday at your children's birthday party because you're liable to get copyright violation. If you really care about these things, and you really care about making sure that we are protected in the most fundamental way in terms of just how we speak and how we think and how we regurgitate material, because, you know, as much as we're creative beings, we don't create anything out of
a void,
right? Yeah. We create everything out of pre-process. So the question comes up to, what is copyright? We reuse everything. What is plagiarism? I don't even know. I mean, obviously, you take word from word Shakespeare and you claim it's your own. It's plagiarism, right? And copyright. Well, actually, there's no copyright there. Not yet, anyway. But they're working on it. But if you take, you know, Hemingway's work and you re-say it in the regular course of the conversation as we've had here many times, actually last week's conversation we were talking about To Whom the Bell Tolls, and we prevent ourselves from being able to regurgitate that material, then we have denied ourselves of our basic humanity and our basic ability to just function as human beings. You know, we will not even be allowed to take the life experiences that we have and refocus them back out as an expressions of our existence, which is the artistic and the scientific. And this is really it. This is what humanity is all about. This is where the artistic and the scientific and the mathematical parts of all of us is all converged. It's basically an expression of our human existence. And it's dependent on our ability to fairly use material and to reuse it over again. Just really to live our lives as human beings with any type of quality whatsoever. It goes so far beyond even just free software. It has to do with everything.
Only one small aspect.
Yes,
it's
you know, people don't understand. The free software aspect is really, the only reason why the free software aspect is as big as it is because so much of human communication now goes through computers and even more so in the future. And that's why it's critical. But in the larger picture of things, we're talking about the most basic ability of humanity to express itself as a person. And on that note, I think we'll end the show. God be willing, may everybody have a great week. May you have a profitable week. May you have a healthy week. May you have a loving week. And I hope to see everybody at our new classes starting next week. And we also have a board meeting coming up hopefully soon. And Michael Richardson's going to kill me, so let me remind everybody that if you have a journal article that you want to get published, make sure you get that published by June, by tomorrow. Haha. All right.
And so everyone stay up late tonight, right?
It's actually very serious because that's what I probably do tonight, is stay up late writing it. All right. And have a great day.
Thanks for tuning in.